The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP. Annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University, Red Sky, and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Jane Suggs.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here, and welcome to today's City Club Forum. And this is a forum on tiny houses and small footprint homes. I'm Jane Suggs, and I'm a City Club board member, as Richard said, and I'm also today's moderator. And I want to acknowledge a few people that have helped put this forum together. Our forum series sponsors Echelon Group, and thanks to Mary Ryman, who's sitting with us at the head table, and our friends at Micron and also Perkins Coie. Our media partners are KBSX, KBSU, Boise State Public Radio, KBOI Radio, which is 670 on your AM dial, and Pepper Shock Media. Excuse me. Thank you to our sponsors for all the contributions you are making to continue the conversations like we're going to have today. I also want to thank my forum co-chair, Terry Ottens, and the rest of the forum committee, and our hardworking staff, as you see them when you come in the door. We really appreciate it. And I also want to thank my co-workers at WH Pacific for hosting a table so they can see me sweat. And thank you too much to our audience here and on the radio. Let me tell you a little bit about how we'll do this. Following three presentations from our three speakers, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions, and that's the bulk of our forum today. There are question cards on your table. You'll see them on the center of the table. Fill those out. Raise them up like this, and someone will come by and pick those up and bring them up to me. So I will get to go through those questions and ask those of our panelists. While I'm speaking, why don't our panelists just come right on up here and have a seat? Today's forum topic we've entitled Living Large in Small Spaces. I'm kind of interested in this topic, and I'm interested in it both personally and professionally. Personally, because the research shows that the folks that are living in these homes, these smaller homes, are millennials, empty nesters, and older single women. I say professionally because I'm a land use planner at WH Pacific, and tiny homes are actually becoming an important part of the fabric of our communities. Could it be that the mega mansions that we've been so used to seeing are now kind of on their way out, and maybe small, livable homes with quality materials and finishes might be in vogue now? Let's hope so. I'm going to begin with a little bit of a definition, because we talk about tiny homes, and typically we're talking about the tiny homes on wheels, and you might have seen those on TV. They have their own TV shows now. These homes are a lot like a recreational vehicle. Our panelists are going to talk about that a little bit more as far as definitions go. Some of these small homes are actually constructed on foundations. I call them sort of small footprint homes. They are different in their way of construction. Again, we're going to talk a little bit more about that. And there are also different zoning requirements that allow those homes to either be built someplace or parked someplace if they're on wheels. We've put together a really good panel to educate us on the ins and outs of these small homes. First, Dana Zuckerman recently completed and quickly sold out her first subdivision of four tiny homes on Silver Street, and that's in Northwest Boise. Dana has a master's degree in public policy from the University of Chicago. She serves our community by serving on various boards, including CCDC, TRICA, and the Idaho Commission on the Arts. Dana admits that her love of housing comes from living in some of the world's greatest cities, places like Boston, New York, Montreal, Tel Aviv, and Boise. For Anne, she also finds out that she watches a little bit too much HGTV. Jesse Collinsworth is the owner and CEO of Tiny Idahomes. Since 2014, Jesse has been building tiny homes at his growing business in Caldwell. Jesse's going to tell us about his tiny homes, who lives in them, and maybe a little bit about his experience on HGTV. Hal Simmons, in the middle here, is the planning director for the city of Boise and has been on the forefront of many of the city's master plan communities, or master planned areas, including Lusk Street, Central Addition, Fort Boise, and the River Street area. He's our zoning expert, and he's constantly looking for ways to improve our city codes to encourage pedestrian connectivity, accessory dwelling units, and also new smart growth development. Oh, one more thing. A lot of people think about tiny homes and equating them to homelessness and how to solve our homelessness issue. I'm really proud that City Club has actually sponsored two forums in the past year on homelessness. So we've kind of already dealt with the issue of homelessness. What we'd really like to do today is just talk about tiny homes as part of our housing fabric and not necessarily delve into that issue, because that's a whole big issue. Why don't we start now, and Dana's going to give a little presentation and tell us a little bit about her project, and then, no, I'm sorry, we switched that up. Hal's going to talk a little bit about what these houses are like, definitions of those houses, and some of the benefits and drawbacks from those houses, and then Dana will speak, and finally Jesse will talk to us. Hal?
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, we're really quite proud of the housing choices that we have available in our community today. Over the years, we've explored many forms of housing in terms of alternatives like accessory dwelling units, skinny houses, row houses, cottage housing, live-work housing, stacked flats, mixed use, and other concepts. The latest concept that we're all dealing with is that of small footprint housing or tiny houses. It's important for us because our population in Boise is very diverse. We have many smaller and non-traditional households. We have a higher median age than the rest of the county, and as well as many service workers in need of moderate-priced housing near their jobs in and around the downtown. What I'd like to do quickly here is to share some of our experiences and the things we've tried here in Boise to accommodate, and maybe some of the pitfalls and some of the challenges and what might need to happen in the future. Boise entered the small footprint arena in about 1998, when we adopted our first standards for accessory dwelling units. These are otherwise known as ADUs. This is the allowance for a homeowner to add a second small unit to their existing single-family house and use it as a rental. Our code requires that an ADU cannot exceed 600 square feet in size. It can be as small as you want it to be, actually. So it really is small footprint housing and even enters the realm of tiny housing, of stick construction. ADUs can be internal to the house, they can be attached, or they can be a freestanding structure in the backyard or the side yard, provided you have room for the setbacks. So when people ask me if we allow tiny houses in Boise, my answer is, yeah, we do. We normally call them accessory dwelling units. They're a low-impact, almost invisible way for a homeowner to generate income through use of the property as a market rental, or to house an elderly parent, or a teenager, or a young adult in the family. ADUs are approved administratively with no need for a public hearing. Very quickly, I'll mention skinny houses on 25-foot wide lots. I know that those have sort of a bad reputation in the city. They were controversial, but we've come up with development standards that limit the house size and the height. And what we found is they're well accepted in the neighborhood, and they become a more affordable form of single-family housing and also more compact. Probably not a tiny house, but there's nothing that says you can't build a tiny house on a 25-foot lot if you want to do that. And we have a good inventory of those from the early 1900s. Our zoning code will also allow creation of new small lots up to the density limit of the zone. We have a residential zoning district specifically intended to allow subdivision into 18-foot-wide lotting patterns. That's primarily used for row houses. It's also possible to create new narrow lots through our subdivision process using our standard conventional single-family residential zones. It does require a planned unit development application through the Planning Commission. It takes about 6 weeks and a public hearing. That's the process that Dana used in her project that she's going to talk to you about today. It allows for flexibility, creativity, and more density and compactness in our housing stock. It allows for new product types than what we normally would see with our standard, with our base standards. Another concept we're supportive of is that of cottage housing. That's the idea that a number of small freestanding units can be constructed on a lot, perhaps clustered, and then the required parking and open space can be clustered elsewhere on the lot. So you might not have a garage associated with your individual unit or attached to it, but it's elsewhere on the property. That, again, goes through the planned unit development process in a public hearing. Again, only 6 weeks. We had a recent project like this approved on Ormond Street in the Vista neighborhood. The homes were, they were small footprint housing. The smallest ones were around 650 square feet. But it was well accepted in the neighborhood, and it's a good sort of beginning first step into the concept of tiny houses clustered on larger lots. I want to say just a few words about small houses on wheels in Boise. At this point in time, we do not consider them as to be habitable housing, partly because they're not placed on foundations and are not subject to building permits. There's a large do-it-yourself movement associated with wheeled homes, which means there's a great deal of variability in the quality of construction, the materials, the durability, and the aesthetics. You know, we could allow them and would allow them to be clustered in an RV park on commercially zoned property. When people have asked us about constructing an RV community or a wheeled community, we steer them towards the idea of picking one of our commercial zones on one of our boulevards where we are promoting housing, and again approving that through the conditional use permit process as well. Jesse at Idaho Tiny Homes builds a great product to nationally recognized standards, and he's going to talk to you about that today. I want to touch briefly on the issue of taxation and services. We're a full-service city in Boise. It's important to us that taxation is equitable, and that the users of services pay their fair share for those services. Again, that's partly why we, at this point, frown on moving a wheeled home onto a property. It's very possible to move a trailer onto your backyard, run an extension cord and a garden hose to it, and whoever's living in that is not, that property is not assessed. They're not paying taxes. They may be paying rent to the landowner, but they're not paying into the assessments that go to pay for things like police, fire, parks, roads, schools, and other emergency services. It's clear we have more work to do in accommodating new concepts as they evolve. I think we're going to need to rethink many of our zoning standards, including things like how many parking spaces we require for a small unit, density allowances in our residential zones. If you're building a very small footprint, you can probably exceed our lower density standards fairly easily. Setbacks might need to be modified, and even the public review process. But the good news is our zoning code contains no size limitations for houses. If you want to build a 200-square-foot house, you can do that, at least according to zoning. The stumbling block has been the International Residential Housing Code, Building Code, that hasn't contained restrictions on the size of units and how they're constructed. The good news there is that the national code has recently been amended to include an appendix that specifically is geared towards accommodating tiny houses with very small footprints. We intend to adopt that, to be one of the first cities to adopt that. It's on our public hearing docket at the City Council in December, and we expect to have it in effect in January of this year. So that's good news, I think, for the tiny house movement. More good news is that we have, over the years, adjusted our fees to more accurately reflect the reduced impact of tiny houses or smaller homes. When I talk about fees, I'm talking about building permits, ACHD impact fees, sewer connection fees, parks, fire, and police impact fees. For a conventional 2,500-square-foot single-family home in Boise, you pay about $11,000 just in permitting and impact fees. And until recently, that was pretty much the fee you paid for an accessory dwelling unit as well, a small footprint house. We've managed to reduce the impact fees to where they're about $4,500 now for an accessory dwelling unit of 600 square feet in size. I think we have more work to do in that regard, but it's a starting point to making small footprint housing actually affordable. If wheeled housing is to become part of our actual housing mix, we're going to need to resolve issues related to aesthetics, construction standards, construction safety, utility provision, and really importantly, how assessed value and taxation is fairly addressed for the occupants of wheeled housing. So I'll just conclude by saying that we're here as a city of Boise to listen to the ideas that these people bring to the table. And there are a lot of innovative things going on in the housing world today. Dana found a modular housing unit builder for her project. Jesse, again, builds a high-quality RV product that has potential as a livable form of housing, easily in an RV park, but potentially in other settings. We recently were contacted by a company in Boise that manufactures modular storage containers. well, storage containers, with the idea that they can be stacked and used for residential product. And we've actually approved one or two projects using storage containers. So there's a lot of good ideas out there. And with that, I'll end my opening remarks.
Thank you. Thank you, Hal. Hi, I'm Dana Zuckerman. I'm here today because I recently completed a development that contains four small homes on a third of an acre in the Collister neighborhood. And by small, I mean three of them are one bedrooms that are under 600 square feet. One of them is a two bedroom that is under it's around 700 square feet. The question most people ask me is how this started, how I got here. I'm basically a stay-at-home mom who's involved in the community with and I have a background in public policy and urban design. I've gone to so many workshops and talks and breakfasts where people talk about the missing middle. Like, what do we do in a place where people, the average wage earner, makes $50,000 a year, and our average home price, depending on what neighborhood you look at and whose numbers you're using, is somewhere between $200,000 and $300,000. That just doesn't match up. At the same time, I have a pretty serious addiction to shelter magazines, which are also known as house porn. And these come in paper and in blog form, and you can spend hours and hours looking at beautiful houses from mansions to very small houses. And in the last decade, smaller housing has become very popular. It used to just be in Europe and Japan, and now you see it all across the United States, and not just big cities, but little cities as well. So it was one forum I went to, I believe it was ULI. It was very interesting, again, talking about the missing middle in a room full of developers. And I walked out of there and was just like, you know, someone's got to do something. This is ridiculous. So I looked for a piece of land. I found a third of an acre with a decrepit house and on a street. And I'm very concerned about the urban context of where small homes belong, excuse me. And so I found a third of an acre on a street that was mostly duplexes but also had a few cottages. So I thought this is the right place to put small homes. And I decided it was time for an experiment. I wanted to see if people in the state of Idaho would go for this. Would they trade square footage and space for lower price brand new housing, proximity to downtown, proximity to amenities and transportation? And in my naivete, I just set on my way. I'd never developed anything before. I'd been involved a little bit with planning, but, you know, didn't know how to start with foundations and driveways and things like that. So I met with a bunch of contractors and tried to figure out how to build these small houses and keep my costs low. I very quickly realized that wasn't possible. As we all know, the cost of construction is pretty high right now because of the demand. And I quickly turned back to my shelter magazines and saw all of the modular buildings that were out there that really could keep costs lower and keep the quality of the building up. And it turns out that the Treasure Valley has a wealth of builders in modular housing. They were literally just, you know, miles from where I was looking. And the one I settled on is in the offices in Nampa. They're factories in Caldwell, and I went and looked at a few different models. I redesigned some of the kitchens because I really cared how the kitchens looked. I put some higher end materials in some of them, and while those houses were being built, I did all the site prep. Dug, but when I say I don't actually mean I. I mean I hired people to do it. You know, we put in the drainage pits, put in. Had the excavator get ready for the foundations, put in foundations, and then miraculously overnight, these houses were trucked in, craned. I saw houses that I had paid for, craned, hanging on a wire, spinning in the air, and set on foundations one at a time. So people who live on that street left in the morning and saw an empty lot and came home in the evening, and there were four houses. It was a sight to behold. So after a little while of getting the houses ready to go, they had to be hooked up to utilities, the same as any house that's stick-built anywhere. You wouldn't know looking at them that these houses came from a factory. they were ready for sale. I put them on the market with a realtor. My realtor, Alicia Ralston, did this for me pro bono because she believed in the project. She put them on the market on a Friday. We had an open house Saturday. By that Tuesday, I had signed the last of the contracts. And then after they were sold, I had about a dozen more people contact me who are interested in buying more of these houses. The sales price, it's all public. I wanted to go lower, but because my costs kept going up, I had to raise the prices a little bit. They were from the 140s to 170 for the two-bedroom. So I believe my experiment worked. There are people in the city of Boise who are willing to trade space, square footage, all the things we think people in Idaho really want for a simpler life, smaller house, lower cost. These people are not indebted to their houses. They live in them. There's one woman who bought a house who said that the house allowed her to retire. And then I saw she had just bought a car and parked it right behind the house. So that this lower-cost housing allowed her to do that. And there was another woman who was quoted in the Statesman who said that she had been paying more rent on her apartment than she's paying in mortgage on this house. So the plan is to do more. And I really hope that other people steal this idea because I think we can't have enough of this level of housing in Boise. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dana.
Thank you.
So first I'm going to say sorry. I'm used to having a mic and walking around. I'm a very active person, so this is weird sitting at a table. Normally it's in a fairground showing off a tiny house. So yes, I started Tiny Idaho Homes 4 years ago. We were located out in Nampa off Kings Road. We started literally with a 3,000 square foot two-bay shop. I started building tiny house on wheels. Some people use the acronym of THROW in the tiny house world. But I started because my wife and I are avid RVers. And I got to say, RVs nowadays have just went downhill in the quality that they're built. And here in Idaho, we like to hunt, fish, and we like to do it year-round for the most part. At least I do. So I wanted something capable of leaving up in the mountains, McCall, Cascade area, and not worrying about my roof caving in. And so we did at that time. We did own a different manufacturer RV, and the roof did cave in. So that's kind of where the idea came from. And the whole time I was rebuilding that roof, I was very frustrated on how they were built. So I had kind of done some research. I'm an electrician by trade. I was actually working, I believe, my wife can correct me. I think I was in Cody, Wyoming, doing Marriott hotels in the middle of winter. So that right there would make me change my career anytime. So I'd done some research, and I told my wife at the time, I said, I'm going to build a tiny house. And she said, no, you're not. So I came home, said I quit my job, and I'm building a tiny house. But our product out there, we're now located in Caldwell. We have 22,000 square foot facility we just moved into in November. We currently have, I think, 22 employees. It fluctuates weekly. If you own a big business in manufacturing, you know what I'm talking about. So we build everything from the trailers to finished product out the door. We started building our own trailers shortly, about 6 months after, because I couldn't find a trailer manufacturer to build it for the foundation that I wanted for my mobile tiny houses. From day one, I reached out to the RVIA, which is an RV membership group. They look after us. They protect our. They stand behind us and come out and make sure do inspections that we're building to an ANSI and NFPA code and DOT code. They don't necessarily touch the DOT. They worry about the inside stuff. So I reached out to them. It took me 9 months of fighting, literally conference calls, everything else, to get. I'll say a lot of these guys that sat at the table were owners of RV manufacturing companies, and they did not want my product to be part of their organization. So after 9 months, I pretty much convinced them that my product was no different than theirs, other than it looked different on the outside. The way I convinced them was stating, if you look back, and I still tell customers to this day, if you look back to the 1960s, 1950s, all campers were built with stick frame building, and they were built much nicer. And I know that for a fact, because you can go out to the streets now and see 1960s, 1970s units on the roads. But if you look for a 1992, I doubt you're going to see too many of them. And most of them are rotted away, or they just didn't make it. So in my mind, that was built to a different standard. It wasn't built as nice. So I kind of went back in age and went back to the stick frame building. And I still build to an RV code. My product is built for road. We did become the members of RVIA. We are the only member of RVIA building this kind of product in the state of Idaho right now. After that, we decided we were going to build our own trailers. I also reached out to NATM, which is a trailer manufacturing association that comes out and makes sure we build trailers to code. It's very important to me that I set the standards for the products up higher, so I kind of lead the pack, so to say. So I reach for the skies when it comes to any kind of memberships or certifications I can get for my product. Here we are 4 years later. We employ roughly 22 employees, and we currently are doing almost one a week. I would say three a month for sure. And by the end of 2018, my goal is to do two a week. We are shipping from coast to coast and even Hawaii. We got dealerships, some sales guys, I call them sales guys, in Oregon, California, Washington, and Hawaii. And Hawaii is doing very well right now. So locally, we sell a few here locally, but we got them all the way, like I said, from coast to coast, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire. I mean, we got them everywhere. They get hauled on the road just like any other RV would. Transportation companies haul them for us. But our product, you know, it is a 2x4 constructed walls. We use Romex residential plastic boxes, just like you see in any other house, PEX plumbing pipes, and metal roofs. So it is built thicker. We use an R15 insulation. It's a blow-in fiberglass insulation. We can do spray foam. So we do quite a bit of custom work, but we do slide outs, things like that, that makes our houses unique, because most tiny house manufacturers don't do slide outs. It's very easy for us because we also build truck campers. We started building Northland truck campers in November when we moved into the new facility. They're called Rugged Mountain, but it's the same company. So under my roof, we build tongue trailer and gooseneck tiny houses and truck campers. So as far as tiny houses go, I'm going to talk some statistics here, what everybody's interested in. When we talk about who's purchasing our product, I can easily say this year, because it changes quite often, our number one purchaser is divorced and single women in the late 40s, early 50s, I would say. Coming in a strong second is the military. And I ask people, we always like to ask what they're going to use it for. Most of our customers do full-time live in these units, even though that's not what we do. My wife and I use ours for camping. We always have the nicest trailer in the campground, too. But the military, when you ask them, the wives, they get stationed quite regularly, and they're getting tired of packing up and moving all the time. The military will pay to move their RV. And a lot of military bases has very nice RV parks. Sure beats a barrack, huh? Number three this year, it kind of made a flop, would be college kids. Whether it's parents buying them for a college kid or college kids just finishing college and they don't want to settle down in one area. I do firmly believe that you're going to start seeing RV parks at college campuses if it keeps going the way it's going. Our product is designed to pull down the road. They pull very, very nicely. Our fifth wheel, our 35-foot fifth wheel with three slides, is roughly about 1,000 pounds heavier than a traditional four-season RV on the road. But trucks nowadays can handle that. But I personally can tell you it pulls nicer than any other fiberglass-sided fifth wheel I've ever pulled. So that's the falsity that a lot of people hear. And I know that because we have good speed limits in Idaho. So our show unit last year that got sent to Hawaii had over 20,000 miles on it going to shows, and I would estimate somewhere in 150,000 people had walked through that unit. Probably more than that because we did one show that over 60,000 had walked through it. So if you did that with a regular RV, I can almost guarantee it would not look in show condition like that tiny house did. We call them RVs, but I'm going to say tiny house, but it's still an RV in my world. So, you know, I don't believe that our product's going anywhere. I think it's just getting more and more popular because people definitely like the luxury to move around. Most of our customers have moved their tiny house, whether they say they don't ever plan to. They end up moving it. Life changes, or they decide, hey, I have this. I do want to travel. We have a customer that built theirs 3 years ago. They have roughly 40,000 miles on their unit. They stopped in this year, and it still looks almost as good as it did the day it left. That is why we build this product, because it is much nicer and holds up much better than any standard RV in my world. And I know because we build truck campers with 1.5-inch walls also. Another question we get a lot of times is, one of the reasons they do this is cost efficiency. It's affordable housing. It's not low income housing because it's by no means cheap to buy one of our products. Our standard price starts around $40,000. But we have a guy in Phoenix that, what do you say? It's about 100 degrees roughly during the summertime. His monthly cost in his RV park that he runs into, because they have to pay for their utilities, is roughly $28 a month to keep that thing at 72, did he say, Anka? I think it was 72 degrees. So with an R15 insulation in 200 square feet, it does not cost much to cool it down or heat it up. So that's very appealing. That's what's affordable about this. It's the lifestyle, the monthly bills, and sure, you're still paying $350 to $400 bucks a month lot rent, but that, in my book, is taxes, you know. I guess we can probably get to the questions, because I know there's going to be a lot of questions.
Yeah. Thank you so much to our panelists for talking to us. And thank you for that oversight and the insight into tiny homes and small footprint houses. Before we turn to some questions, and we have a lot of them, so thank you very much. I want to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to the City Club of Boise Forum on tiny houses and small footprint homes. And our speakers today are Dana Zuckerman, Jesse Collinsworth, and Hal Simmons. So thank you. Lots of questions, some of them specific to some of our panelists. But let's get started. Because this is one I get to go, because it's me. What are the steps that are needed to be taken to change our zoning laws to accommodate the tiny houses? I know how you talked about the City of Boise wanting to do that. What do you see? Is it lot sizes? Is it always a PUD? Tell us a little bit about what you foresee to allow these, even tiny houses on wheels.
Okay. Our zoning code is tied directly back to the comprehensive plan. So when we establish zoning standards, those standards have to be reflected in the policies and the goals and the visions portrayed in the comp plan. For the most part, our comp plan talks about building a compact community that's transit-oriented, that provides a mix of housing. And our zoning codes allow pretty high density today to accommodate some of those goals. Our standard single-family zone allows up to 8.5 units per acre. You know, most people, when they think about a single-family low-density residential zone, they're talking about, you know, three houses, you know, per unit or per acre. In Boise, we're talking already 8.5 units per acre. So I think that there's flexibility in our zoning code right now to allow tiny homes under the existing zones. If we wanted to go more dense than that, I think we need to come up with some new zones. And I think we may have to amend some of our land use policies and designations to do that, but it's not a huge stretch. I think that the starting point might be our allowances for accessory dwelling units. The idea that we already allow you to add a second unit behind your house, and you know, right to today it has to be stick built, but it would be a fairly simple change to the zoning code to allow a wheeled structure instead. But you know, whenever you amend the code, though, or the comp plan, it comes down to, does the public buy it? Do they accept it? It's a public hearing process. You have to meet a lot of expectations for what people have about their neighborhoods and their community. And if you're radically changing the density and the product types, you know, it's a harder sell. So I'll just say that, you know, we know the number of complaints we get about neighbors moving in a relative in their camper in their driveway. You know, there's an expectation that homeowners have that housing is permanent and that it becomes a, you know, high quality permanent fixture in their neighborhood. The idea that you wheel something in and out is a big change. So I think there's an avenue to allow more compact development, to allow smaller housing. But I think the idea of the wheeled housing is a high hurdle, and there's going to have to be more public dialogue and more public will to allow it before it can happen. It's a public hearing process to get there.
Thank you, Hal. I've got quite a few questions for you, Dana. And I'm going to kind of bunch them together here. A lot of folks want to know about the features of your small footprint homes, if there were any garages or garages of enclosed garages possible, and who was the modular builder for your homes. I think you mentioned that they were local, right?
Yes. The modular builder is United Family Homes. Their office is in Nampa. Their factory is in Caldwell. I did not build garages because I didn't want to add to the cost of the houses, but I was required to put parking pads behind the houses. And I'm not saying this in front of Hal, but there are, I did notice that a few people who live in the homes put storage sheds where the parking pads are, which I wasn't allowed to do, but I don't know if they were allowed to do, but they did.
I didn't hear you say that.
I did not say that publicly, but people need a place to keep their bikes, especially if they live close to the Greenbelt and probably bought a house purposely close to the Greenbelt. And I forgot the last thing you asked.
I think that was it.
The amenities. Sorry.
Yeah, amenities like the finishes inside the house.
So it was very important to me that every house have a porch. I think there's nothing that makes a neighborhood more than a front porch. So when you work with modular housing, you're working under constraints of what the modular housing company can offer you. And fortunately, or the reason I chose this modular housing company, United Family Homes, is they had a model that had the front of the house is entirely windows. And it leads out into the porch, and it has a very tall peaked roof that's 14 feet inside, so it feels spacious. And I thought this would lend a nice feel to the neighborhood. And there's a sidewalk in front, which the city required me to put in, but I would have put in anyway because, again, I think it really adds to a neighborhood feel. A mistake that I made about the amenities in the homes is I had the option of putting in higher-end finishes in any or all of the homes, and I did that in two of them. I put in granite countertops and solid wood cabinetry and nicer flooring and stainless steel appliances, and I didn't want to do that in all of the homes because I didn't know if the extra $8,000 that would cost would prevent some people from affording the homes. Well, it turned out that the people who put offers on the houses that weren't upgraded quite as much asked me if I could add those amenities after or those upgrades afterwards. I also made sure that the houses, so by state code, the houses cannot leave the lot until they have full appliances in them. So they have refrigerators, stoves, and dishwashers. But I added washers and dryers because I assume that anyone who's buying a house at this price point can't afford to add anything into it right away.
Thank you for that. There were lots of questions, too, about financing. Is financing difficult for the smaller homes from the normal mortgage companies?
Yes. So I was told by my realtor, and we met with a mortgage broker right away, that there is no precedent for modular housing within the city limits of Boise, which I found very interesting considering that there are all these modular house builders. It turns out that most of them have their orders go out to mountain communities or rural communities where it's harder to find contractors. That became a problem with mortgages because these are not manufactured houses and they're not traditionally stick-built houses. They're modular houses which are built like stick-built houses, but try explaining that to an underwriter who is naturally risk-averse and has never heard of this product. And so the advice I got from my realtor was, hey, let's find a cash buyer for the first one, and that will set the comparable for the remaining three. And I got very lucky because, like I said, two of my four homes were bought by retirees. One of them had sold a house around the corner that was about a 3,000-square-foot house, and she had the cash to buy her. She bought her house with cash, and that set the comp for the other three, and the other three were allowed to get traditional mortgages.
And construction loans? Did you have trouble getting construction loans?
No, I didn't end up using construction loans. I got a personal loan. And I worked with Washington Trust Bank, and I'm just going to put a plug in there, who was so good to work with. The nice thing is, I'm not a nonprofit. I'm just somebody who thought this was a good idea and wanted to see if it would work. And I ended up working with quite a few professionals in Boise. I have a friend who works at Holly Troxell who did the legal work I needed for free because she thought this was a cool thing. And like I said, my realtor did this pro bono because she thought this was a cool product to put out there. And then the banker I worked with, Joey at Washington Trust, was also just like, whatever you need, we'll help you. We believe in this product. We know it's going to sell. Let us know when you want money for the next one. So the whole community has been very supportive.
It's nice to hear that about our Boise community. I appreciate that. Jesse, a few questions for you. One is pretty detailed here. What are the relative advantages of wood versus steel framing for your products?
Well, I get this question in my truck campers, too. My truck campers are stick-built also, even though it's 1x2s. But the reason I have not made that transition is on something mobile, we have to use adhesives that adhere our fiberglass sides or our siding to that stick-built or aluminum-built walls. In Idaho, we get cold, hot temperatures. That steel or aluminum is a very good conductor of those, and I've yet to find an adhesive that's going to hold up good enough that I am not worried about warranty issues. If you drive down the road, you see a lot of bubbles on fiberglass-sided RVs. Well, a lot of that, it's called delamination, is adhesives letting loose. And a good thing I always tell people is every truck camper manufacturer, every camper manufacturer in Canada uses wood-built frames still to this day. Why is that? Same reason. I've done multiple tests on steel walls, steel stud walls in my facility, and I have not found something, if I throw it in the freezer, throw it in the cold, throw it in the hot, that is going to hold up the way I want it to. With stick-built stuff, we use ring shank nails. Ring shank nails tend to hold better, almost tears up the wood to come out, as opposed to screws. Going down the road, vibration is a killer. 2,000 miles of nothing but vibration, screws back out. It backs out on traditional RVs. It does back out on ours still, too. But I do try to use ring shank nails and things. And adhesives wood to wood definitely help instead of that cold, hot steel. Plus, wood also gives you an R factor where the steel and aluminum does not.
One more thing, probably the most interesting part of a tiny home. Talk to us about composting toilets. It's a question.
Every time this thing comes up. So I'm not the person that's going to sit here in the back of a composting toilet. I'll be the first to tell you it's not for me. And most of the time, they're not legal. They are if you use them correctly, but the way people are putting them in their tiny houses are not legal. A composting toilet, the high-end composting toilets separate the solids from the liquids. It's the solids that makes up the compost. The urine, they believe it or not, and sorry I talk freely because this is a very hot topic. In bathroom world, it is the urine that smells, guys. But just because you separate it does not make it legal to dump urine on the ground. Urine is still a black water in every state that I know of. Correct me if I'm wrong. He's planning on zoning, but we've talked to the health department many times. They've been out to my shop, too. So what I'm saying is it's not legal to dump black water on the ground. So people think they can dump it in their garden and everything else. Well, I'll tell you what, after doing that for a little bit, urine stinks to high heaven. So when we install them into our RVs, which we do quite often, we still dump that urine into the black tank or the black water line, the sewer line. So they still have to hook it up like a traditional RV when it leaves our facility. I do know a lot of DIYers, the do-it-yourselfers out there that are dumping it on the ground. This is making it very hard for this movement to move forward because it is very important we do things by the book and not upset our neighbors by making our property stink. So, but yes, it's a very common product we put in our units. And I'm not saying compost is bad. I'm just saying use it correctly.
I'm going to go back to you, Dana. You mentioned that the houses came in one day and suddenly their houses next door. Talk a little bit about your neighbors, their reaction. Did you do a special outreach? And also, when you're looking for additional projects, what are you sort of looking for when it comes to the next small footprint home project?
Well, I had a neighborhood meeting like anyone has to have that does a planned use development, and I had about five neighbors come out who were all irate that I would dare put four houses where there was one house. And the one house, as I mentioned, had been empty for several decades. I don't know how many. There was debris all over the yard, from cans of things we couldn't identify to gas cans, tires, things that you couldn't even identify. Windows were broken. So I thought I was coming in and doing something good for the street. Well, it turns out the neighbors didn't agree with me. The argument over and over was, well, if you're going to do something, why not build one big house? It's a third of an acre. You can build a big, nice house. And that's just not what I was interested in doing, and I just kept trying to assure that my neighbors, my soon-to-be neighbors, that I would build a nice product, and people did not want low-income neighbors. That's what I heard. And I said, well, these are for-sale houses. A, that's, not really a nice thing to say, but B, these will be houses for sale, and you have to generally have a job or some money to buy a house that costs $150,000, $160,000. So that was my outreach. It didn't go smoothly, but it went. And then I went to planning and zoning, and two of those neighbors showed up, and one of them in front of the Planning and Zoning Commission said the same thing. We don't want low-income people in our neighborhood. And the commissioner, whose name I don't know, very nicely said, we don't zone low-income people out. And that, yes, it was impressive. I'm sorry I don't remember the man's name because I would like to thank him. I'm thanking him now. The reason I wanted, as I said, I wanted to do this project on this block is because I felt like it fit. Half the block is duplexes, and they're not fancy duplexes. They're duplexes that are filled with people who aren't high-income people, and then that's on one side of me, and on the other side are single-family homes that are probably around 1,500 square feet. I happen to notice that in two of them, they're single men who take very good care of their houses. So I thought this was a really good fit for this block. And I think that a lot of urban design and building good neighborhoods is all about fit, right? You don't want a McMansion in the middle of small cottages, and you don't want, you're not going to build a little wooden shack in Quail Ridge. I mean, it just has to suit the neighborhood. And so that was important to me when I was building. Once the neighbors saw what was going in, two people from across the street who live in duplexes came to me and said, "Can you save one for me?" And I said, these aren't the same people who protested. But two neighbors said, "Can you save one for me?" And then they asked the price, and they said, "Can you give me a deal?" And I said, "Sorry, I just can't," because they wanted to pay about half of what I was putting them on the market for. And I would have liked to, but I couldn't afford to do that. A few other neighbors came by. It was very interesting. I worked in the front yard quite a bit. I did xeriscape and did it by myself. And so I'd see people driving by slowly and say they live in the neighborhood. What am I doing? What am I up to? How much are these houses? What was interesting there was some people were very excited to see that old house gone with the broken glass, and it was dangerous, and they were so happy to see something new come in. And other people looked at me and said, are those HUD houses? As if that was the worst thing ever. And so I just smiled and said no, and then they kept driving. And since then, I've only gotten I've only gotten positive feedback to my face. Behind my back, I've gotten a lot of negative feedback, which is something that we talked about. The number of people who have opinions on what I built, which again, the frontage of these four houses is exactly 100 square feet, or 100 linear feet. It's not like I built Harris Ranch. But somehow, it seems like half the city has an opinion and decides to express their opinion on what was just built. And I'd like to say to all those people who wrote comments on, the Statesman did a very nice article on me, and people posted things on Facebook, and I would like to reply, but decided not to, and just say, if you don't like one, don't buy it. I think that's how housing works. I mean, we all don't like a lot of housing that goes up, and that's just not the house you choose to buy. So when I look for my next, I'm searching for the next place to do this, and I will just make sure that it suits the neighborhood. I don't want to carve up any lots that don't suit the neighborhood. I want to make sure that anyone who buys a small home has access either to the greenbelt or the bus, some other form of transit, so that perhaps we can have a good argument to limit the number of parking spots we need, that sort of thing.
And one of our questions came early in the discussion. Someone's a family of four, so parents and two kids looking at moving into a tiny home. Is it important to be near certain things, parks, schools? You just mentioned the bus lines, infrastructure. I mean, are those all the things? I mean, do you need to be close to a park because you don't have a big yard?
Is that for me?
Any of them. Anyone.
Yeah, I'll just start off by saying we think everybody ought to live close to all those facilities. We do our best to make sure that we have a community that's fine-grained enough that those things exist in close to most neighborhoods.
A few interesting questions here about containers. And you mentioned that a little bit, Hal. You mentioned containers. And this person said there are hundreds of thousands of stranded ocean-going containers out there. How is it possible for maybe the codes to change to use containers? And what's up with those containers? Are they getting around some of the land use laws by using containers?
They're not. We have one that we recently, our building division approved it. They required engineering on the how the containers were constructed and stacked and integrated into the house, but it was a fairly easy approval. And from a zoning standpoint, if it meets our setbacks and height standards, you know, we're going to approve it. You know, if you're working in a historic district, there are going to be maybe some issues associated with materials and architecture and stuff. But the bottom line, as I understand it, with containers is it's just a module that you add in, and then you cut windows in it as you need. You put whatever siding on it that you want. You insulate it. You can put a pitched roof on it. It doesn't have to be just a flat. You know, I think they get used today as sort of a modern form of housing with a modern style, but it doesn't have to be. So it's just another form of modular housing as far as we're concerned.
And they meet building permits requirements.
You know, for zoning is the least of our hurdles. It's the building code that really is the difficulty. But in terms of wheeled houses, the building code's the big hurdle. Storage containers, for some reason, it hasn't been much of a hurdle because they're easily engineered, but they work. I think the problem is when somebody brings in a completed product and wants to set it on a lot, our building division has no way of knowing how that thing was put together. They can't look in. It's very difficult to look in the walls and without taking the thing apart and understanding that it's actually safe and not going to self-combust when somebody starts, you know, cooking in it. So
I just want to add to that. I looked into using containers. I think they're really cool. They don't save much.
No.
They are basically a shell. It saves you some framing costs, but you have to outfit them the same way you'd have to outfit any stick-built house. And if you look into your costs, I mean, maybe it shaves off $1,000 here or there, but that's only a maybe. You have to put in the utilities, insulation, everything else. So I'm not really sure how that's... It's not a lower-cost way to build.
I think it's the reuse factor that's making the containers...
Yeah. It's cool.
You know, spotlight, but insulation's not fun on them. 2x4s are cheap compared to a $2,000 container. I mean, you can frame that thing out for under that price. So, yeah, use container at $2,000. So, cost-wise, it doesn't pencil out. I think it's the reuse factor, the green, get rid of these old containers sitting around.
And I just want to add on that note, for the kind of housing we're talking about, a lot of the cost isn't actually the house itself. So some of those people who drove by and like to make all sorts of comments at me would ask, how much are these houses? And then I said around $150,000, and someone looked at me and said, wow, some guy's going to make a lot of money off that. And I just, you know, smiled and waved. But then when I broke down my costs, the houses themselves were 43% of my overall budget. And again, in the Statesman, there were a lot of comments that people were like, "Oh, that you could buy one of those for $65,000." Well, you can, but that's not with any bells and whistles, and that's not with land, and that's not with driveway and drainage and all the fees you have to pay and engineering and everything else. So, modular housing is a lot less expensive to build, but still, I had 57% of other costs involved in this development.
And do you know if that's typical of a lot of developments in, you know, standard subdivisions? How do you have a handle on that?
I think it's typical. Yeah, absolutely. It's the cost of land, the improvements, and the impact fees.
Well, thank you very much. I think we're just about out of time, and I still have a handful of questions. What we'll try to do is take these questions, give them to our panelists. Hopefully, we'll, in the next few weeks, be able to get some answers to these questions. We can post them on our Facebook page. So go back to the City Club of Boise Facebook, and we'll maybe get some answers to some of these questions that didn't get asked. Thank you so much for all of the questions. They were excellent questions. Had quite a few about just what are we looking for are the next steps, and I think this is a great panel to address that. First, before we close, I want to say on behalf of City Club, I want to provide you each with one of our highly prized and often considered collectible coffee mugs, City Club of Boise. And I want you to please join me in thanking our speakers, Dana, Hal, and Jesse. Thank you.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club Forum is on Thursday, the 7th of December, and features historian Jill Gill, director of the newly formed Marilyn Schuler Human Rights Initiative at Boise State University. Register for that lunch forum at cityclubofboise.org or by calling 208-371-2221. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.